And from the KTOO newsroom, I'm Yvonne Crumry. Hundreds of voters in Alaska are waiting for results in the Philippine national election. Polls closed early this morning. Most votes have been counted, and Ferdinand Marcos Jr. is projected to win. Marcos' father was the dictator who was ousted from power by a popular uprising in the 1980s. That's when many Filipinos fled the country and ended up in Alaska. And now some voters here are pinning their hopes on having Marcos in office again. Jennifer Pemberton from KTOO reports.
Leo Evangelista got two ballots in the mail in the last few weeks.
I voted for our U.S. Congress, and then I just voted for the Philippine president, you know.
Evangelista is a dual citizen. He's lived in Anchorage since the early 90s and has worked as a mail carrier for more than 25 years. It's a common job for Filipinos in Alaska.
The family always said, you want to be a nurse or you want to be a mailman?
His wife works for the post office, too. They didn't mess around when they sent their ballots to the consulate in San Francisco. They added extra postage and sent them priority. He's not too worried, though. His candidate, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., is expected to win. Even if you're not following Philippines politics closely, that name is probably familiar to you. Marcos Jr., the candidate, goes by his childhood nickname, Bongbong. He's the son of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos. His father ruled the Philippines from the mid-1960s to the mid-1980s, part of that time under martial law. Evangelista is like so many Filipinos who left the country either during the Marcos regime or shortly after. It was a very tumultuous time in the Philippines. He says life is better in the U.S. because there are jobs.
Opportunity. That's why I moved here. Yeah.
But life is better in the Philippines, too, he says. It's cheap and warm. And besides, it's home. He hopes that under the leadership of another Marcos, the country will continue to become more like how he remembers it. He plans to move there as soon as he retires. On the Friday night before the election, Rochelle Solanoy is driving around Juneau, picking up three of her girlfriends to go get Filipino food at a restaurant in the valley.
And we're celebrating because Bongbong is going to win.
In 6.5 years, she'll retire from her state job. She's also planning on moving back.
Because when you go home to the Philippines, you feel like a queen. You know, your money stretches.
She's excited about Marcos's promises to keep cleaning up the cities, to keep building infrastructure, and to build a new economy. She dreams of a big reunion in the Philippines, a homecoming for all the overseas workers. The older people will retire on the beautiful beaches. The younger people will finally have jobs there and be reunited with families some of them have never met. But Solanoy wasn't always a Marcos supporter. She left the Philippines in 1981 when she was still a kid, but she went back to visit in 1986. She was a teenager, and she says she got caught up in the revolution to unseat Marcos.
And I kind of like listened to them. I mean, they portrayed Marcos to be the dictator. Of course, I believe all of that.
But she has since relearned the political history of her country. She says she's still learning through YouTube videos. In these videos, the years of martial law in the Philippines are now remembered as the golden years. And Marcos is remembered as a philanthropist. This narrative has emerged from the intentional spread of misinformation on social media. But Solanoy thinks she was lied to for 30 years.
That's why I was like, oh my God, I was so stupid. A lot of people are thinking that way now. So we want Marcos back.
When Marcos wins, and she's confident he will, she's going to the Philippines.
I want to go visit him. I want to go to Malacañang, and I'm going to like really talk to him because...
Malacañang is the presidential palace. She wants to talk to him in person and make sure that there's a place for her and her friends to return to after 30 years away. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
An 8-person crew of scientists, artists, and divers are trying to locate the site of one of the deadliest shipwrecks in Alaska history. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, expedition members say they hope to find the wreck and shine a light on the disparity of the tragic deaths. Most of the passengers who died were Asian cannery workers, and to this day, many of their names are still unknown.
It's a dramatic spring evening in Wrangell, black clouds and sharp shadows in the golden hour sun. Alaska artist Ray Troll is standing at Reliance Harbor, watching a gray metal box swing from one of the yellow cranes built into the dock. It's being lowered onto the deck of a 72-foot black and white ship.
Those are oxygen tanks, I believe, for scuba diving. They're very heavy.
Troll is part of an 8-person expedition searching for the wreck of the Star of Bengal, an iron-hulled Alaska Packers Association salmon packing ship that went down in a storm in 1908 off the coast of Coronation Island here in southeast Alaska. The group includes a remote sensing specialist, a marine archaeologist, a researcher, an artist and writer, a Wrangell commercial fisherman, and a boat dog named Bella. They're all sailing on the Alaska Endeavor, with a U. It's a former U.S. Army boat built in 1956, owned by Patsy Urschel and her husband.
I think of this as a right brain, left brain kind of a project. So it's got the scientific aspects of it, of discovery, but it also has the cultural pieces too.
For expedition captain Bill Urschel, the project stands out from other shipwreck explorations because of the story of the Star of Bengal.
This is a special wreck because of the cultural significance. It's not just a ship that went down. It's a social system that went down with it.
All but one of the 111 cannery workers from China, Japan, and the Philippines on board the Star of Bengal died on September 20th, 1908, when the ship sank. 15 of the 36 white crew died.
I think that's where that sense of injustice really kicked in for me.
Tessa Holes is a writer and visual artist and a member of the Endeavor crew looking for the wreck. For the last 5 years, she's been working on a graphic novel exploring three generations of her family, from the communist takeover of Shanghai to the United States. She says that for the white men who died aboard the Star of Bengal, there's plenty of information. Full names, ranks, even insurance payouts to spouses.
And then you try and find any information about any of the Asian passengers, and it's always... and about 100 Orientals, Asiatics, or a word I'm not going to say. You know, it's just, they get so lumped together.
There are conflicting reports about how exactly the Star of Bengal went down in 1908 and what the abandoned ship looked like. But some firsthand accounts tell of the mates and masters of the vessel, all white, leaving the ship without freeing the cannery workers who were locked in the ship's forward hold. She says the story of the wreck says a lot about Asian people's struggles throughout America's history.
It's this incredible microcosm that tells about a century of how Asian Americans were first coming to this country, what the practices were with them being migrant workforces.
In all likelihood, Hulls says the Endeavor crew will never be able to find the names of all of the Asian cannery workers who were killed when the Star of Bengal went down.
But I think telling the story of why we can't find their names is the closest that we're going to get to justice on this.
Wrangell commercial fisherman and diver Gig Decker believes he found the wreck of the Star of Bengal more than 3 decades ago and has been working ever since to research and pique interest in the story of the wreck.
You know, the ship was from Wrangell. They worked here, and they're a part of my industry. And, you know, I feel, you know, an obligation.
Already, there's a place set out at the Wrangell Mariners Memorial to honor those who died in the wreck of the Star of Bengal, in a large part thanks to Decker. For Troll, who calls himself a connector and brought much of the 8-person crew together, the mission to find and authenticate the wreck is about respecting the humanity of the victims of the sinking, who have since become victims of history.
I think this is a story about respecting their humanity, and there were certain people that were, their humanity was respected, and others it was total disrespect. And I hope that what we're doing here is maybe trying to bring that respect and to honor them in some way.
The journey of the Endeavor and its 8-person expedition crew started Friday morning at the old APA cannery site, about where Wrangell's airport now stands. From there, it traces the 82 miles out to Coronation Island, the same route as the Star of Bengal, where they'll spend a week documenting their efforts to find its wreck. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And Alaska State Senate has voted to pay Alaskans $1,300 on top of their permanent fund dividends. But the total payment to Alaskans remains up in the air as of Monday afternoon as the Senate debates its version of the state budget. Senator Mike Schauer of Wasilla said the high price of oil means the state has money available.
While I'm not an advocate of spending money that you don't need to spend, I think the argument is right now we actually have it because oil prices are high, because there's a war. That's why people need the help.
Senator Tom Begich opposed the energy relief payments. The Anchorage Democrat said he was concerned that the payment would mean less money available for a $1.2 billion plan to fund education a year in advance.
Based on how we've built the budget here in the Senate, it's clear that this money would then come at the expense of forward funding of education. And that's not an exchange I'm willing to make.
The amendment added energy relief payments passed 12-7 on bipartisan basis, with several members crossing caucus lines. The state House approved a similar energy relief payment when it passed its own $7.7 billion version. This is KTOO.